Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on 1 second after, right after this. You know, we Americans may be the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if your plumber said that? What if your plumber said he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? What if your carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? You know, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself has to be incompetent, just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he said. He said, it's a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. So it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without ever having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. A student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. That's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, educational, informative, and it's free. Now, our school courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. All right, we're ready to go. We're talking about this thing 1 second after. It's a book written by a fellow named William R. Fortune. Odd name, F-O-R-S-T-C-H-E-N. I guess it's Forced Chin. And in the second book, I'm going to review both at the same time. It's called The Last Babylon. Both fiction now, but both deal with Bible prophecy. They deal with the predicted outcomes of a nuclear bomb war here in the United States, and you can apply that to France or England or Ireland or Japan or China or any place that you live in the world. It's not very likely that you living in Kazakhstan or Afghanistan, you're going to get a nuclear weapon down your throat, but it's pretty likely here in the United States. It's possible in Western Europe. Any of you people living in Holland or France, England, Ireland, Scotland, you know, less likely in Ireland, but, you know, possible. But here in the United States, it's a guarantee. There isn't any doubt in anybody's mind. None. Zero. Zilch. We're going to get nukes right here in the USA. How do I know that? Ezekiel told us that. Ezekiel. Now, a lot of times, you know, when people read the Bible, they kind of cluck a little bit. They go, and then they'll shake their heads, you know, kind of roll their eyes and say, oh, my God, you don't believe that kind of crap, do you? Absolutely. If I didn't believe it, I wouldn't have told you. Kind of reminds me of the guy said, well, I didn't want to hear that. I said, well, you shouldn't ask. If you didn't want to hear it, you shouldn't ask. So you shouldn't turn into this broadcast because you're going to hear some stuff here you might not have wanted to know. Now, the reason we can be certain about Ezekiel's prophecy is that Ezekiel's prophecy, this whole book of Ezekiel, is written to the tribe of Israel. It's written to Israel, not Judah. This isn't for you Jews. You can sit back and relax. We got some prophecies for you guys, too, but this isn't one of them. This book is written to Israel, and in particular, the number one tribe in Israel, Ephraim. Ephraim and Manasseh, that's England and the United States. Now, you Englishmen over there, you got yours in World War II. We didn't. And we're about to get ours in World War III. When this thing comes down, it's going to be dreadful. Dreadful. But Ezekiel wrote 127 years after the tribes of Israel went into captivity under Shalmaneser. That was in 718 B.C. 127 years later, Ezekiel ends up in a concentration camp. And God comes to him and says, hey, write this down. I've got a message for you. And this is for the house of Israel in the end times. End times. So he wrote two chapters here, chapter 5 and chapter 6, and they deal with nuclear bomb war. They deal with the complete destruction of the nation. Here, I'll read it to you. Now that I'm here, we'll just flip over here to Ezekiel, is it Jeremiah, Ezekiel? Here's Ezekiel 7. Flip back a page. Listen to this. In chapter 5, he says, "You son of man, you take you a sharp knife, and you take a barber's razor, and you cause it to pass upon your head, and then upon your beard, and then take 3 balances to weigh and divide the hair. And you shall burn with fire a third part in the midst of the city, when the days of the siege are fulfilled. And you shall take a third part and smite about it with a knife, and a third part you shall scatter in the wind, and I'll draw out a sword after them. And you shall also take thereof a few in number and bind them in your skirts." There's a few of them going to survive this. Take a few of these hairs. These hairs represent the people of the United States of America. And a few of us are going to get salvaged out of this. Well, you know, the people that believe in the rapture, you know, those guys, they figured that they're going to get off here scot-free. I'd like to. I don't know if I'm going to be one of them or not. I'd like to be one. You can read the rest of the chapter yourself. I'll jump up a little bit further, verse 12. Listen to this. He says, "A third part of you shall die with the pestilence, and with the famine shall they be consumed in the midst of you. A third part of you shall fall by the sword round about you, and a third part will scatter into all the winds, and I'll draw out a sword after them." So here's the way it's coming down. There's going to be a siege, and we're going to have famine here. A lot of people are going to die from famine and disease. Then the war is going to come, take another third of us. And then the survivors are going to be scoffed at and deported. And Deuteronomy 28:68 tells you where you're going, Egypt. That's one of the places, not the only, but one of. In verse 6 of chapter 6, it tells us about our cities being laid waste, which wasn't possible until World War II. And then with the nuclear weapons, hey, well, that tells us a story right there. Here's chapter 6:6. He says, "In all of your dwelling places, the cities shall be laid waste, and the high places shall be desolate, and your altars may be laid waste and made desolate, and your idols may be broken and cease, and your images may be cut down, and your works may be abolished." Cities laid waste. Now, the religious people, they call here at the law school every once in a while, and they kind of castigate me, and they say, "Don't you have any faith in God? Don't you have any faith in Jesus?" Well, I would, except that Jesus already told us the answer to the riddle. And here's what our problem is with sweet Jesus. Nice try here, but here's what happened. He gave us some instructions some time back, and we gave him the finger. And so he sent us a message. It's in 1 Samuel chapter 8. So if you thought that you can pray to sweet Jesus and get out of this jam, more power to you, but I don't think it's going to work. So I tell my students here very plainly, we've got a problem that needs a solution. As a matter of fact, we've got 64 problems. So this week I wanted to tell you about a new problem came up. It's called the EMT. It is problem number 65, and it has to be solved. Now, if you don't have a solution to the problem, we don't need to talk about it. Fortunately, this EMP problem has a solution. We can weather that storm. We can weather the hurricanes and the tornadoes and the famines and the war and the deportation. I mean, all of this can be weathered. We can prepare for it. We can hunker down. But this thing of waiting for Jesus to do it, and he says here in verse 17, "He will take the tenth of your sheep, and you shall be his servants. And you will cry out to me in that day because of your king, which you shall have chosen you. And the Eternal will not hear you in that day." This whole chapter 8 over here, it's quite a little story over here. See, years and years ago, our people had a pretty good deal scoped out with the creator of the universe. And he pitched us a deal. It was over at Mount Sinai. Moses came down off the mountain and said, "Well, here's what the terms and conditions are. God says that he wants you to practice these 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments." You know, like the Ten Commandments. He says in return for that, he's going to give you 33 articulable benefits. You know, like rain in due season, and rulership over the nations, and everything that you put your hand to do will prosper, and none of your children or none of your cattle will abort, you know, things like that. And the people at that time, you'll see this recorded in Exodus 24, verse 8, the people said, "All that the Eternal has said, we will do and be obedient." So we had a contract there. It was an offer. It was God. You know, he was up on top of the mountain and says, "Hey, Moses, come on over here. Let me pitch you a deal here." Moses got the deal, took it down to the people. So here was an offer. The people accepted it. They said, "All that the Eternal has said, we will do and be obedient." So you get an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. And that's what a contract is. They even went so far as to write it up. It's in writing here. This is a sworn statement. You know, for you people out there who didn't understand what the Bible is, it is a sworn statement. It's a contract. And the contract terms are located in Exodus 19, verse 16 through Exodus 24, verse 8. No big deal there. But we got to breach a contract here. And see, God pitched us a deal. We accepted it, and we performed on the contract. Things are going along pretty good, see? And then our forefathers here, you know, 300 years later, they got a little uppity. And they came to the judge. At that time, his name was Samuel. See, old Moses died. Joshua took over. He died. Then a string of judges came along, you know, guys like Gideon and Samson and others. And they all died. And then pretty soon we come up here to the last judge in Israel. Last judge. His name was Samuel. In fact, there's two books written here in the Bible, 1 and 2 Samuel. That's what we're looking at right here, 1 Samuel chapter 8. And Sam was a pretty good old guy. And And the people came up to him one day, and they said, "We want a king. We want a king. We're tired of these damn judges. We don't like this government anymore." And Samuel was really shocked, so he went to God. He had the inside track with God. See, he can go talk to God any day of the week, but the rest of us guys couldn't. And we had to go talk to Samuel. And then Samuel would go up to God and get the word from him, come back and tell us what was expected of us. Well, Samuel was shocked right out of his gourd. He goes over to God and he says, "Hey, listen, these people are demanding a king." And so God told Samuel. And the thing displeased Samuel, and when they said, "Give us a king," and Samuel prayed to the Eternal, and the Eternal, this is God, "Now I said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people and all that they say. Because they haven't rejected you, Sam, they've rejected me, that I shouldn't reign over. According to all the works which they have done since the day I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, wherewith they have forsaken me and served other gods, so do they also unto you." So we gave him the finger. That's all. No big deal. We had a choice to make, and we made it. So God got a little bit uppity at the end of this thing over. He said, "Now you guys better go think this through. You know, you guys are making a mistake here. Go think about this overnight and come back and tell me this in the morning." And you know what the people said in verse 19? "Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel." They said, "Nevertheless, we will have a king to rule over us." So God acquiesced, and he said, "Well, okay, that's the way you got to have it." So he said, "You're going to be sorry about this, but you know that's what you want." That's why he said to us, he said, "Now, you're going to cry out." See, we just got this healthcare thing passed the other day. Boy, we ain't seen the end of that trick yet. You know, they said that thing's going to cost us about $900 billion. Oh, no, no. Troops, wake up here. There's never been a government program that ever came in anywhere close to budget. Never. Never, never, never. I mean, don't you remember old George Bush? He said, "Hey, we're going to go over to Iraq, and we're going to clean their clock, and then it'll cost us under $50 billion. Hell, you people have spent $1 trillion over there, and you ain't seen the end of it yet. $50 billion, that's what he said that thing's going to cost you. Social Security, same thing. Social Security is bankrupt, $40 trillion upside down. Okay, how do you like that? Oh, no. No, this healthcare thing is going to cost you $4 trillion coming out of the chute. $4 trillion, four times what the president told you. And then you won't see the end of it. But that's another story for another day. Now, I tell my students when they come in here, I say, you know, I'm not opposed to prayer, and I'm not opposed to you praying to God, but I'm just telling you that we got a geopolitical problem over here, and our God told us, he said, "Now you made your bed, now go sleep in it." Now, boys, we're going to have to sleep in this bed, and it ain't going to be comfy. So I just thought I'd throw that out there to you, tell you the answer to that riddle. Now, religious people, they want to pray to Jesus and hope that he takes care of it. He's not going to take care of this EMP problem. He might send you an EMP problem with a solar flare off the sun. That happened in 1859. So we've had that happen here before. If that thing happens again, boy, that thing's going to turn turtle on us. Now, I've got an article here called "Nuclear Electronic Pulse" by Jerry Emanuelson. So write this down, and I'll give you a place here where you can go find this. Now, remember, we got two books here, "Last Babylon" by Pat Frank. You want that book. The second book is "One Second After." That's written by William R. Forstchen, F-O-R-S-T-C-H-E-N. This third one over here is now by Jerry Emanuelson. Now, we're going to solve this problem. And I'm not going to just tell you that you got a problem here. I'm going to show you how to solve this. The first thing we got to do is recognize we got a problem. Second thing is we got to figure out, well, what's causing this problem? And third thing we got to figure out is, now, what do we do about it? Problem, cause, and solution. Got your pen out? You ready? www.futurescience.com. www. You got that? Futurescience, all one word, .com. And you're looking for the article on nuclear electromagnetic pulse. 12-page article. Now, in case you don't have a computer and you're living in some backwater in India or Pakistan, I'm going to cover some of the highlights here in the article. So watch this. The topic of nuclear electromagnetic pulse, called EMP, is very mysterious to most people, and it is quite commonly misunderstood. And it's also the subject of a large amount of misinformation. It is a persistent problem that many people want to ignore, and science, or to ignore the science, and to make it into a political issue. Now, there are separate pages on EMP, personal protection, Soviet nuclear EMP tests in 1962, and on other topics, including a separate page of notes and technical references. Much of this information here describes the possible effects of EMP on the continental United States, but the information can be used to describe the effects on any industrialized country. In testimony before the United States Congress House Armed Services Committee on October 7, 1999, the eminent physicist Dr. Lowell Wood, in talking about Starfish Prime and the related EMP producing nuclear tests in 1962, had this to say. He said, quote, Most fortunately, these tests took place over Johnston Island in the mid-Pacific, rather than the Nevada test site, or electromagnetic pulse would still be indelibly imprinted in the minds of the citizenry of the western United States, as well as in the history books. But as it was, significant damage was done to both civilian and military electrical systems throughout the Hawaiian Islands, which was located more than 800 miles from ground zero. The origin and nature of this damage was successfully obscured at that time, aided by its mysterious character and the essentially incredible truth. So when this occurred back in 1962, the government covered it up. Now, the people in Hawaii had a lot of their electrical equipment fried. But in 1962, there wasn't near as much to fry as there is today. It also happened naturally one time back in 1859 when a solar flare did this, also known as the Northern Lights. So it could come in one of two ways, and this article here will point that out to you. If the Ruskies or the Chinese don't do it to us deliberately, you can rest assured that accidentally, just by happenstance, it will happen from a solar flare. But it's going to happen at some point in time. Now, most people that are trying to bet on this give the odds of a solar flare occurring, 50-50, and of the chances of the Russians or the Chinese doing it to us, about 20 to 70%. Now, those are pretty good odds, 20 to 70% or 50-50. Well, 50-50 is it'll either happen or it won't. Now, I'm 70 years old and it ain't happened yet. So my natural inclination is, well, if it hasn't happened yet, it probably isn't going to happen. Don't bet on that, because when this happens, you're going to be a sad puppy. I'm going to be a sad puppy. We're all going to be sad puppies. Those of us that prepare for it better than the other guys won't be quite as sad as the other guys are going to be. I mean, everybody's going to be sad, but some people are going to be downright miserable. So here's the story. It's called the Starfish Prime Nuclear Test. Although nuclear EMP was known since the earliest days of nuclear weapons testing, the magnitude of the effects of nuclear EMP were not known until a 1962 test of a thermonuclear weapon in space, which was called the Starfish Prime Test. The Starfish Prime Test knocked out some of the electrical and electronic components in Hawaii, which was 897 miles, 1,445 kilometers away from the nuclear explosion. The damage was very limited compared to what it would be today, because the electrical and electronic components of 1962 were much more resistant to the effects of EMP than the sensitive microelectronics are today. The magnitude of the effect of the EMP attack on the United States will remain unknown until one actually happens. Unless the device is very small, it is likely that it would knock out the nearly entire electrical power grid of the United States. It would destroy many other electrical and especially electronic devices. Larger microelectronic devices and devices that are connected to antennas or to the power grid at the time of the pulse would be especially vulnerable. Let me point this out. Over the years, these electrical devices are getting smaller and smaller. Now, back in the 70s, when you had a boombox radio, it had transistors in it. And those transistors would take 2 or 3 volts. Today, you've got these micro circuits. They only take a tenth of a volt. So depending upon where your radio is located, and whether it's a 1970 model or it's a brand new model, will depend upon how it's going to come through the electronic pulse. The pulse will have somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 volts to it. Now, it can be as high as 300 or 400 volts, but typically it's going to be about 50. When this 50 volts hits, if you've got a 2 or 3 volt system in your radio, and if your radio is partially protected, it might come through it all right. But if you've got one of these little handheld micro transistor radios or a telephone, that thing's going to fry in a heartbeat. And the more modern the electrical equipment or the electronics equipment, the more likely that it's going to be destroyed. Now, there's a thing here called a Faraday cage. There's a way for us to protect our electrical equipment. I mean, you can actually stash this stuff away. You can set off this nuclear bomb. You can have the EMP pulse, and your stuff will all survive it. But you got to be ready for it. Now, we'll talk about this Faraday cage as we proceed along. This Starfish Prime Test was detonated at 59 minutes, 51 seconds before midnight, Honolulu time, on the night of July 8, 1962. Official documents give the date as July 9th because that was the date of the Greenwich Meridian known as Coordinated Universal Time. It was considered an important scientific event, and it was monitored by hundreds of scientists and scientific instruments across the Pacific and in space. Although an electromagnetic pulse was expected, an accurate measurement of the size of the pulse could not be made immediately because a very respected physicist had made calculations that hugely underestimated the size of the EMP burst. Consequently, The amplitude of the pulse went completely off the scale at which the scientific instruments near the test site had been set. And although many of the scientific instruments malfunctioned, a large amount of data was, in fact, obtained and analyzed in the following months. When the 1.44 megaton W-49 thermonuclear warhead detonated at an altitude of 250 miles, that was 400 kilometers, it made no sound. There was a very brief and a very bright white flash in the sky that witnesses described as being like a huge flash bulb going off in the sky. The flash could be easily seen, even though the overcast sky at the islands, about 2,000 kilometers to the west-southwest, it was called Kwajalein Island, K-W-A-J-A-L-E-I-N. After the white flash, the entire sky glowed green over the mid-Pacific for a second, then a bright red glow formed at sky zero where the detonation had occurred. Long-range radio communication was disrupted, a period of time ranging from a few minutes to several hours after the detonation, depending upon the frequency and the radio path being used. All right, so this thing is going to interfere with radio and television transmission. Make up your mind to that. Now, last time I pointed out that the telephone companies used to harden their switchboards or their repeater stations, such as we have here in Theodosia. Assuming that we were hardened over here in Theodosia, my telephone here in my office isn't. And my handheld telephone, you know, my portable telephone, it isn't. So they're going to get fried. Now, let's suppose I want to call my mother out in Seattle, and she's got the same kind of telephone equipment that I've got, and it's fried. Even though our telephone exchange works, all of us are going to be sitting here with all of our fried equipment. We won't be able to call anybody. But if you have a Faraday cage and you have a spare telephone in your cage, and your mother out in Seattle, let's suppose that she has a spare telephone in her cage. After the event transpires, I go to my Faraday cage and I get mine out, and I call my mother, who gets hers out, and assuming that our telephone exchange over here is hardened and it's still up and running, I'll be able to call Mom in Seattle. Most people are going to get wiped out. Some people won't. Now, the military, they say that they're pretty well hardened, and it's going to be pretty hard for you to knock out the military communications. I've seen some reports that even the military isn't nearly as prepared for this as they ought to be. But they'll probably survive this better than most. Many telephone exchanges are going to survive this. But many of them won't, because in the past, you know, 10 or 20 years, people have been dropping their guard and they're not paying attention anymore. And so now they're putting in new equipment, and they don't prepare for EMP. All right, we're at the halfway point here, so let me give you a reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and the biblical law from a scriptural perspective, not state schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact discs, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you want to download our free introductory CD package, go to our website, georgegordon.org. Click on to the archives page and download it. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors and publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to endorse and recommend us. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about electromagnetic pulse. It comes from two books. The first book that we're reviewing here is called One Second After. It's a novel by William R. Forschen. I just bought this recently. My wife did, I guess, down at Barnes & Noble. Published fairly recently. It looks like about 2003, was it? I'm looking here again. I thought I saw 2000-something here. Nope, 2009. Copyright 2009. Brand new book. Hot off the press. The other one's The Last Babylon, a little tougher for you to find. It was printed, my first printed back in 1959, but it's been reprinted as recently as 1993. So, not as new. It's called The Last Babylon. Pat Frank is the author. Now, if you'll go to your used bookstore, if you can't find this one at Barnes & Noble, go to a used bookstore. Tell them to plug in The Last Babylon in their computer, Pat Frank, the author, and they'll find you one in Cape Town, South Africa, or someplace else. You need both of them. Both of them are dynamite books because for what we're dealing with here, Bible prophecy. This is where Bible prophecy and reality come together, right here. Two fiction books. We haven't had a nuclear war here in the United States yet, so we're trying to figure out just about what the effect is going to be and who it's going to affect. That's the name of the game. Now, there's a third article on here. Make sure you get this one down. Third article. You're looking for nuclear electromagnetic pulse. That's the title of the article. Nuclear electromagnetic pulse. And the author is Jerry Emanuelson. Jerry Emanuelson. And you want to go to the www.futurescience.com webpage. Again, that's futurescience.com. It's all one word. Now, I'm giving you a report from this fellow Emanuelson. Going on, in a phenomenon unrelated to the EMP, the radiation cloud from the Starfish Prime test subsequently destroyed at least five United States satellites and one Soviet satellite. The most well-known of the satellites destroyed was Telstar 1, the world's first active communications satellite, totally destroyed. Telstar 1 was launched the day after the Starfish Prime test, the day after. And it did make a dramatic demonstration of the value of active communication satellites with live transatlantic television broadcasts before it orbited through radiation produced by Starfish Prime and other subsequent nuclear tests in space. Telstar 1 was damaged by the radiation cloud and failed completely a few months later. Nuclear EMP is actually an electromagnetic multipulse. The EMP is usually described in terms of three components. The E1 pulse is a very fast pulse that generates very high voltages. E1 is the component that destroys computers and communications equipment and is too fast for ordinary lightning protectors. The E2 component of the pulse is the easiest to protect against, and it has similarities in strength and timing to the electrical pulses produced by lightning. The E3 component of the pulse is a very slow pulse, lasting tens to hundreds of seconds, that is caused by the nuclear detonation having and heaving the Earth's magnetic field out of the way. It is then followed by the restoration of the magnetic field to its natural place. This E3 component has similarities to a geomagnetic storm caused by a very severe solar flare. In writings on the Internet, there is nearly always much confusion about the very different aspects of the various components of nuclear EMP. In addition, there is much confusion in distinguishing high-altitude nuclear EMP, non-nuclear EMP weapons, and solar geomagnetic storms. There are very large differences among these very different electromagnetic disturbances. Although there are many similarities linking solar geomagnetic storms and the E3 components, but not the other components of high-altitude nuclear EMP. Now, the E1 component of the pulse is the component that is the subject of most writings. The gamma rays from a nuclear detonation in space can travel great distances. When these gamma rays hit the upper atmosphere of our Earth, they knock out electrons in the atoms in the upper atmosphere, which travel in a downwardly direction at relative high speed. This forms what is necessarily a coherent vertical burst of electrical current in the upper atmosphere over the entire affected area. This current interacts with the Earth's magnetic field to produce a strong electromagnetic pulse, which originates a few miles overhead, even though the nuclear detonation point may be 1,000 miles away or more. Since the E1 pulse is generated locally, even though the original gamma ray energy source may be in space at a great distance away, the pulse can cover extremely large areas and with an extremely large EMP field over the entire affected area. Now, the magnitude of a nuclear EMP over the United States would be much larger than the tests in the Pacific would indicate. For any particular weapon, the magnitude of the all of the components of the EMP are roughly proportional to the strength of the Earth's magnetic field. Now, the Earth's magnetic field over the center of the continental United States is about twice the strength as at the location of the Starfish Prime test out in the Pacific. Johnston Island is now somewhat larger than it was in 1962 because of the dredging project in 1964, and the airport is now closed. Starfish Prime and the other United States high-altitude nuclear tests were launched from the northern corner of Johnston Island, which you can see in this WICO Mapia satellite view of Johnston Island. Starfish Prime was a 1.44 megaton thermonuclear weapon, but was actually extremely inefficient at producing an EMP pulse. Much smaller nuclear fission weapons requiring far less expertise would be much more efficient at producing EMP, especially the very fast E1 component. In general, the simpler the nuclear weapon, the more efficient it is at producing EMP. Thermonuclear weapons, so-called hydrogen bombs, are very inefficient at generating the fast rise time E1 pulse. Weapons with a high energy yield are much better at generating the slower geomagnetic storm-like E3 pulse that caused much of the damage to Kazakhstan in the Soviet test mentioned below. This E3 pulse can induce large currents, even in long underground electric lines. Now, several countries have produced single-stage nuclear weapons with energy yields of well over 100 kilotons. These would be much more efficient at producing an EMP pulse than the Starfish Prime detonation. The very first nuclear weapons test by France had a yield of 70 kilotons. In the early 1950s, the United States had a stockpile of 90 bombs of a high-yield fission weapon that would have been a powerful EMP weapon. These were 500 kiloton single-stage fission bombs known as the Mark 18. Very little was known about EMP at the time that the Mark 18 was in production. The only actual test of the Mark 18 bomb was done at the Pacific Ocean Test Range on November 16, 1952, at an altitude of 1,480 feet, about 450 meters. So nothing was discovered about its possibilities for high-altitude EMP, although it appears that the actual yield was closer to 540 kilotons, which was higher than its design yield. By now, some countries undoubtedly have very advanced and enhanced EMP nuclear weapons, although these details are highly classified. Now, the Mark 18 bomb, which was tested in 1952, was also known as the Super Oraloy bomb. It was made of a spherical shell of very highly enriched uranium surrounded by a sophisticated symmetrical implosion system. Although it is often described as a very advanced device, it was actually designed by people who did not have computers of a power that is anything even approaching the power of computers that you are using to read this webpage. More than a half century ago, at least 90 of these bombs were built by the United States. In 1952, they were trying to conserve the highly enriched uranium in the stockpile. So the Mark 18 was surrounded with a natural uranium tamper, and anyone making a similar weapon for EMP use could probably enhance its EMP effects by using a tamper made of enriched uranium and using a relatively thin outer casing made of an aluminum alloy. In addition, there are techniques for increasing the energy of the gamma rays beyond the levels available in the first and second generation nuclear weapons. These techniques would increase the electric field of the EMP beyond the old maximum of 50,000 volts per meter. Now today, if just one of these 500 kiloton bombs like the Mark 18 were detonated 300 miles above the central United States, the economy of the United States would be essentially destroyed instantaneously. Very little of the country's electrical or electronics infrastructure would still be functional. It would likely be months or years before the electrical grid could be repaired because of the destruction of large numbers of transformers in the electric power grid that are no longer made here in the United States. Several countries today have the ability to produce a weapon similar to this 1952 bomb and then send it to the necessary altitude. England tested a single-stage weapon with a yield of 270 kilotons. It was called Orange Herald on May 31, 1957. Now, the other countries with this ability will undoubtedly be increasing in the coming years. Now, the instantaneous destruction of the power grid would occur primarily because of the widespread use of solid-state that is SCADA, Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition Devices, in the power grid. And these would be destroyed by the L pulse, the E1 pulse, but could probably be replaced within a few weeks. The greater problem would be in the restarting of the power grid. No procedures have ever been developed for a black start, that is, a total startup of the entire power grid. It's never been done. Something starting a large power generation station actually requires electricity. The greatest problem would be the loss of many critical large power transformers due to the geomagnetically induced currents, for which no replacements could be obtained for at least a few years. The loss of many of these power transformers would greatly complicate the restart of the parts of the grid that could be more quickly repaired. Well, let's think about that one for a minute, because we've had that thing go down now a couple of times. There was a blackout twice in New York City. We had one here in the eastern United States here in 2003. Now, there's one state in the Union, Texas, that isn't on the power grid, but this power grid is a marvel. It's a marvel of technology, which will probably prove to be our Achilles heel. But here's how it works. The people in Los Angeles at, say, 5, 6, 7 o'clock are in the peak of their power need. At the very same time, 10, 11, 12 o'clock out in New York City, they don't need as much power. So what we want to do is we want to move the power from New York State to Los Angeles, California. Now, there's a limit to how far you can transmit power. You can't just turn the switch on in New York City and get power out the other end in Los Angeles. It dissipates by transmission over the lines. So they start the process. Los Angeles starts taking power from Nevada. Nevada, then, to replace their lost power, takes their power then from New Mexico. New Mexico is losing power, so they reach over and take power from Texas. Texas isn't on the power grid, so they don't do that. New Mexico then would have to take their power, let's say, from Oklahoma. Yeah. Oklahoma now is losing power, so they reach over and they take power from Missouri. Missouri now needs more power, so they reach over and they take the power from Tennessee. Tennessee now is short of power, so they reach over and they take power from Kentucky. Kentucky now is short of power, so they reach over and take power from Virginia. Virginia now is short of power, so they reach over and take power from Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is short of power now, so they reach up and take power from New York. New York, remember, doesn't need as much power, so they can generate that power and furnish all the power that Pennsylvania needs. Pennsylvania's got plenty of power. They ship it out to Virginia, and they just ship it across the country. Now, all of this has to be regulated. And all these power companies have to be paid and compensated for the power that they're burning coal and generating. And so they've got control stations, and these control stations are marvels of electronic technology. I mean, they can get this thing right down to the gnat's whisker. And that's where our vulnerability comes in, because unless these installations are hardened, when this EMP goes off, it's going to fry their equipment. It's going to fry transformers. Things are going to get knocked out and burned up and wrecked. And the whole grid's going to go down. Now, can you imagine the United States of America with no electric power all at the same time? You talk about chaos now. So I told you in the last program, I said, you know, if I was a planner over in Russia or China, I'd put that right at the top of the list. That's going to create more chaos, more problem, more trouble than anything you can imagine. If you drop a bomb on Los Angeles, you can rest assured Washington will know about it in 5 minutes or less. And you set off three of these EMPs across the country, and there won't be anybody that knows whether their hind ends are bored or punched. It'll be months before anybody figures it out. And that's one of the points that are made here, or is made here, in this book called One Second After. When this thing goes off, nobody suspects a thing. They just think the electricity went off. It takes some time before some of these guys start putting two and two together and say, wait a minute, all the cars on the freeway are stopped. Wait a minute, the computers don't work. Wait a minute, the telephone isn't working. You know, when the electric grid goes down, it doesn't affect the freeway. It doesn't affect the telephone. If the telephone goes haywire, it doesn't affect the electric grid. It doesn't stop any cars on the freeway. It's when all of these things are stopped that somebody starts waking up and saying, hey, wait a minute. We can't call our state capital. The state capital can't call us. Transportation shut off. You can't drive from here to the state capital. The power grid is down. There aren't any traffic lights. There's any electricity. Can't pump gas out of the ground. Think about this. You know, you come into your gas station and you want to fill up your car with gas. When I was a kid, this is old technology, I got to admit, but there used to be an old place up at Kettenbaum. I think it was one at Xenia, too, but there was one up at Kettenbaum, up in the mountains. And then the gas truck would come up to Kettenbaum, and they had a tank that was underground. And then so the guy in the truck, he'd stick his hose and his nozzle, you know, into the gas tank, and he'd fill this thing up underground. And then he came over to this great big tall gasoline pump, and it had a glass bowl up on the top of it. And on the side, there was a handle. and you push this handle back and forth across the side of this pump, and it pumped the gasoline out of the ground and up into this big bowl up on the top. And this big bowl on the top held 10 gallons of gas. And so you'd fill this thing up until it reached, and it had levels on there, like 1 gallon, 2 gallons, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 gallons. And then you'd open up your nozzle and fill up your car, and you'd drain out the 10 gallons. If you needed 15 gallons, then you'd fill this thing up again, 10 gallons of gas in it, and then you'd run it out until it was full, and then you'd just subtract how much was in the bowl, how much you'd used out of the bowl, and then they'd calculate that out. You use 15 and a half gallons of gas, and that's what they charge you for. It was all done, no technology involved, it was all done by muscle power. Now, when we go in to fill up our cars, those gas pumps out there are all electronic. They've all got computers in them. They've got circuit boards. And that goes into a control panel inside the gas station. I mean, that thing is so well regulated, you can go in there and give her a $20 bill, and she'll set it for $20, and when $20 is run out, the pump shuts off. That's all electronics. That's the stuff that's going to get fried in this E1 pulse. That's the problem. And once that happens, now you've got to replace those circuit boards. Every gas pump is going to be burned out. And to get it to work again, somebody's going to have to come out there and put new circuit boards in them. Now, boy, that's going to take a lot of circuit boards. Now, there's probably a few circuit boards around. I don't deny that. But you're not going to have circuit boards to replace every single one of them. You're not going to have electronic ignition, down at the O'Reilly Auto Parts store in their warehouse to fix every car in the country. They'll have some on hand, and some cars are going to be repaired. And you can rest assured that the first cars that are going to get priority is going to be the sheriff and the police and the fire engines and those guys. And the rest of us over here are going to wait for a while until that stuff gets back online. So next time we'll take a look at this Faraday cage, and we'll talk about how do you protect your electronics equipment so that it can weather the storm. Wouldn't that just be real special if we could beat them at their own game? Hey, I'm out of time. I got to give you a final reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. Remember, it's open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website.